Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we're diving into a topic that's fascinated me for years, medieval archers.
That's right, and specifically the weapon that made them so feared, the English longbow. Although English is actually a bit misleading from a historical perspective.
Oh, you mean the Welsh origins?
Exactly. The longbow was originally a Welsh weapon. The English only discovered it during the conquest of Wales under Edward I. That was around the end of the 13th century, between 1277 and 1283.
And then they quickly recognized what potential this weapon held. The Welsh used it for guerrilla tactics, but the English, they took the whole thing to a completely different level.
What I find fascinating, during the Middle Ages itself, it wasn't called a longbow at all. It was simply called an English bow, or war bow. The term longbow came much later.
That makes sense. For people at the time, it was simply the bow. They didn't need to distinguish it from other types of bows.
And this weapon decided battles. We're talking about a range of roughly 240 meters. That's, well, if you want to picture that...
2.5 football fields, roughly. I once paced that out at a reenactment site, and it's really impressively far.
Yeah, a comparison like that helps. And now imagine you're an armored knight advancing across that distance. You can see the archers, but there's nothing you can do. You have to push through.
And that's exactly the point, isn't it? It wasn't primarily about piercing armor.
No, the main purpose was something else entirely. It was about creating chaos, disrupting the advance of enemy troops. When thousands of arrows suddenly rain down on you, even the best formation falls apart.
Horses panic, people stumble over the wounded, visibility drops from the hail of arrows. The psychological impact was enormous.
And that's exactly what proved itself during the Hundred Years' War.
At battles like Crecy, 1346, that was such a turning point. The French knights, the absolute elite of their time, were literally mowed down by English archers.
Crecy, Poitiers, Agincourt, all victories that would have been unthinkable without the longbow. The French often had numerical superiority, but against that rain of arrows...
Agincourt has become almost legendary. 1415, a starving, sick English army against a fresh French force with overwhelming numbers. And yet...
What many people underestimate today, it wasn't about precision in the modern sense. Individual hits were nice, but not the goal.
Rather the sheer volume?
Exactly. Picture it like a wall of steel moving toward the enemy. Continuous fire until the ammunition ran out. Volume and speed were more important than individual accuracy.
You see that in the reenactment scene too. When you work with historical longbows, you quickly realize it's about rhythm, about endurance, not about the one perfect shot.
And that required years of training. The archers often came from peasant backgrounds, but these weren't farmers who'd been quickly armed. They were highly specialized fighters.
They started as children, weekly, for hours on end. The body literally adapted to this strain. You can even prove this from skeletal remains.
The Mary Rose, the wreck from the 1540s, revealed quite a lot about this. Some of the archers had deformed shoulders and spines. This weapon shaped their entire body.
What impresses me most is the combination of physical strength and tactical understanding. these weren't mindless shooters just firing in one direction.
No, they had to know when to shoot, where to aim, at what angle. The coordination with the cavalry, with the infantry, it was highly complex.
And yet, the longbow is often dismissed as a primitive weapon, when in reality, it was the high-tech of the Middle Ages.
Absolutely. A weapon that changed kingdoms. Through the longbow, England achieved a military dominance that was actually absurd, given its size and resources.
What I'm also curious about, the construction itself. The bow was relatively simple in design, wasn't it?
Simple in design, yes. A single piece of wood, usually yew. But that simplicity is deceptive. The draw weights that were achieved, we'll take a closer look at that in a moment.
All right, now it's getting technical. When we talk about the power of these bows, we need to talk about draw weights. And there's one source that's told us an incredible amount.
The Mary Rose.
Right, she was one of Henry VIII's most important warships, in service for over 33 years. On July 19th, 1545, she sank during a battle against the French in the Solent, right off Portsmouth.
And here's the special part. She sank relatively quickly into the silt and was thereby preserved. In the 1970s, she was rediscovered and raised in 1982.
According to the inventory, there were 250 longbows on board. 137 of them were recovered, in remarkably good condition. And naturally, they were analysed.
And the results were... impressive is almost an understatement.
The draw weights ranged between 120 and 160 pounds. Just think about that for a moment. A modern hunting bow sits at maybe 50 to 60 pounds. So we're talking 2 to 3 times that.
That's enormous. And these bows from the Mary Rose weren't exceptions. That was standard for Tudor war bows. Today they're considered the archaeological reference standard.
In the community, a rule of thumb has developed. From about 75 pounds draw weight, you're talking about a war bow. Anything below that was more for hunting or training.
Though training is relative. Even a 75-pound bow is almost impossible for most people today to draw.
And then there's the draw length to consider. That's also...
crucial for the overall load. 28 to 32 inches was typical. 34 inches only for particularly strong archers.
A bow with 140 pounds at 32 inches of draw was already in the upper range. Not the heaviest, but definitely powerful. That shows the dimensions we're dealing with here.
One particularly fascinating aspect is the skeletal finds from the Mary Rose. They didn't just recover bows, but also the remains of 179 crew members. 92 of them almost completely preserved.
And you could identify the archers immediately.
From the bones?
From the bones. They had massive changes. Both arms were extremely well developed, because archery works both sides, the drawing arm and the bow arm. On top of that, there was often the so-called os acromial, where a bony projection on the shoulder blade doesn't fuse properly because of the constant strain.
The body doesn't develop that in a few months.
No, that takes years, decades even. The spine was often curved, a pronounced hunched back, arthritis in the elbows and wrists. These people shaped their bodies for this weapon.
This wasn't a hobby. It was a profession that changed the whole person. And when you consider that they started as children...
yes, the body essentially grows around this strain. The bones adapt, the muscles develop extremely on both sides, because both arms are working. This isn't deformation in a negative sense, it's adaptation.
It's an interesting thought. Today we'd classify that as an occupational disease. Back then, it was a mark of quality.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you were looking for an experienced archer, you could recognize him by his posture, by the typical hunched back, by the powerful build. It was like a seal of quality.
That's true. By the way, if these kinds of details fascinate you, feel free to leave a like or subscribe to the channel. That helps us cover more topics like this.
But back to the bows themselves. Modern target archers work with bows around 40-50 pounds. That's already athletically demanding.
And then you just triple that.
Exactly. 140 pounds. That's not just arm strength. It engages the whole body. Back, chest, shoulders.
The technique was also crucial. You didn't simply pull with your arm. The power came from the back, from the large muscle groups. The arms guided more than pulled.
Have you ever tried it? A heavier bow?
I shot an 80-pound bow once. Once. After that, I understood why they trained their whole lives. It's a completely different world.
And these bows had to be drawn not once, but 100 times in a row, in a battle, under stress.
In rain, in wind, with aching muscles. The muscle memory had to be so ingrained that the body functioned automatically.
The Mary Rose gave us an insight we never would have had otherwise. Wood normally rots, bowstrings too. But because of the silt...
Everything was preserved, like a time capsule. The bows, the arrows, even the accessories.
And the skeletons tell their own story. They show us what it really meant to be a medieval archer. This wasn't a hobby, it was a life's calling.
Now it gets interesting. We've talked about the bows, about the enormous strength they required. But how did they actually develop that strength?
It starts with technique. The archers used the so-called Mediterranean draw. The string is pulled with 3 fingers, back to the corner of the mouth.
Similar techniques with the 3-finger draw were probably also used by Normans and Vikings, though even the Bayeux tapestry depicts the archers too schematically to identify the draw technique. The anchor point at the corner of the mouth gives you a fixed reference for every shot.
And what many people misunderstand, it's not about pulling with your arm. The real power comes from somewhere else entirely.
Back and chest.
Right, you use the large muscle groups, the latissimus, the rhomboids, the...
trapezius muscles. It's like rowing. The arm just guides. The actual work happens in the back.
And both arms work together. The front one pushes the bow away, the back one draws the string. That has to happen in coordination, otherwise you lose either power or precision.
I once tried this with a traditional bow, a longbow replica. It had maybe 45 pounds. And even with that, you notice immediately, if you only pull with your arm, you're done after 10 shots.
At 140 pounds, you'd be done after 1 shot.
Exactly. Technique is everything. And you don't learn that in an afternoon.
The English kings knew this too. Edward III issued a decree in 1363. All able-bodied men were to practice archery on holidays, including Sundays.
And other games were banned. Football, for example, throwing stones, anything that distracted from practice.
This wasn't leisure activity, it was military preparation. The crown needed a constant supply of capable archers for the Hundred Years' War.
This went back even further. As early as 1252, there was the so-called assize of arms. It required all men between 15 and 60 years old to own bows and keep them ready for use. But note, this was only an equipment requirement, not training. Practice mandates like under Edward came more than 100 years later.
So that was initially just basic equipment. But the really skilled shooters, of course, did much more. And as I said, they started as children.
That's the crucial point. As an adult, you can't just learn to shoot a war bow. The body has to adapt over years. the bones, the tendons, the muscles.
In England, there had been laws requiring weapons ownership since the Middle Ages. The Statute of Winchester of 1285, for example. Fathers traditionally equipped their sons with bows, even though this was never explicitly prescribed. A tradition passed down from generation to generation.
What did the training actually look like in practice?
There were various forms of practice. The most common was butt shooting, shooting at grass-covered earth mounds that stood in every village. 20 to 100 yards away, man height.
They used blunt arrows so they wouldn't penetrate too deeply and could be reused.
Then there was popinjay, shooting at wooden bird decoys mounted up high. That originally came from Flanders and was more of a sporting, festive custom. Whether it was actually used to train for sieges isn't documented, but you definitely practice steep-angle shooting with it.
Or hunting, birds and trees.
And shooting at the marks, shooting at distant posts in uneven terrain. That was training for artillery-style fire on the battlefield.
So not just mindless aiming at a target, but various scenarios. That makes sense.
The idea was the mechanics of the shot have to be so deeply ingrained that you don't think about it anymore. Muscle memory. Then you can fully concentrate on aiming.
Oh, it's like with any instrument. Only when the technique runs automatically can you really play.
Exactly. And that takes years. The body has to have made this movement thousands, tens of thousands of times.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
What's often overlooked? The fingers. If you release a string with 140 pounds of draw weight, and your fingers aren't protected, you'll quickly get open blisters and deep cracks. It's barely bearable.
That's why finger protection. Leather taps or special gloves, you definitely needed something.
Not just a nice accessory, but essential for anyone who shot regularly. Without protection, you'd have bloody fingers after an hour.
What always fascinates me, these men trained their whole lives for one moment, for the battle.
And then you're standing there, tired, scared, and you have to shoot 100 arrows in a short time. That's when you find out if the training worked.
There was also a clear hierarchy with the bows. Training bows were lighter, maybe 50 to 75 pounds. That's what the young archers started with.
And as they aged and grew stronger, they moved up to heavier bows, until eventually they could draw the full war bow.
It wasn't a linear process. Everybody is different. Everyone develops at different speeds. Some never made it to the very heavy bows.
Which was also fine. Not everyone had to shoot the 160-pound bow. The lighter bows had their place on the battlefield too.
The theory is, the heavier ones perhaps for the first volley at long range, the lighter ones for more precise shooting when the enemy came closer. However, this isn't documented. The Mary Rose finds suggest that draw weights varied according to the archer's build, not their tactical role.
A system that took generations to develop and that gave England a decisive advantage for over 100 years.
Now we come to the actual deployment on the battlefield. And this is where you see that archery in war was something completely different from what we understand as precision sport today.
The philosophy was fundamentally different. It wasn't about hitting individual enemies. It was about covering an area with arrows.
The concept is called volley fire. You don't aim at one man, you aim at a formation. The archers shot together in coordinated volleys, and the result was, well, the sources speak of a wall of steel.
a continuous hail of arrows that darkens the sky. That sounds exaggerated at first, but when you look at the numbers...
At Agincourt in 1415, the English had...
5,000 to 6,000 archers, and each could fire 6 to 10 arrows per minute.
That means in a single minute they could... So if we assume 5,000 archers, we're talking about tens of thousands of arrows in the air simultaneously.
And the range allowed them to fire several volleys before the enemy could even reach them. They could shoot up to 200 meters. For targeted, penetrating fire, it was less. But for area effect, they had time.
The French knights at Agincourt had to advance through this hail of arrows, in heavy mud, in full armor. And the whole time, arrows are raining down on them.
What many underestimate is the psychological effect. You hear the whirring, see the sky darken, and know, in 2 seconds, that's going to hit.
Horses panic, formations break apart, men stumble over the fallen. The chaos was the actual goal.
And that's exactly what made English tactics so effective. They didn't want to kill every single Frenchman. They wanted to destroy the formation before it could even attack.
The chronicles state that the French nobility suffered devastating losses at Agincourt, thousands dead and captured, while the English had minimal casualties.
About 112 documented deaths on the English side. The actual losses were probably higher. On the French side, it was 6,000 to 10,000.
That shows how devastating this tactic was. And as we said at the beginning, it was about volume and speed, not precision.
A single arrow that misses an armored knight, no big deal. 100 arrows striking the same spot, one of them finds a gap.
The arrows were also specially designed for military use. War arrows had an aerodynamic shape, optimized for flight characteristics. These weren't hunting arrows.
The difference?
Hunting arrows needed precision at shorter range. War arrows needed range and penetrating power at steeper angles of impact. The shape of the tips, the fletching, everything was different.
And then there's the logistics. The archers fired until their ammunition was gone. There are no exact records of how many arrows per hour, but the consumption was enormous.
Each archer carried bundles of arrows, usually 24 at a time, in pouches or ready on the ground. That was shot through in just a few minutes.
That's why supply lines were so important. The arrows had to be produced, transported, and distributed on the battlefield. It was a logistical masterpiece.
And when the ammunition really ran out, the archers set down their bows and continued fighting with axes or daggers. They weren't just ranged fighters.
At Agincourt, after the arrow barrage, they charged into close combat. The French knights were stuck in the mud, exhausted from the advance under fire, and then these lightly armored archers come at them with hand weapons.
The image of the noble knight defeated by the common archer, that struck the French deeply. Not just militarily, but culturally too.
An entire social order based on nobility and heavy cavalry was called into question by this weapon.
And the crazy thing is, the English perfected this tactic over decades. Crécy, 1346, Poitiers, 1356, Agincourt, 1415. Always the same principle. At least in these major battles, it was extremely successful.
The French knew what was coming, and still couldn't do anything about it. That shows how superior this combination of training, weapon, and tactics was. When you put all of this together, the weapon, the training, the tactics, then you understand why these archers were so feared.
It wasn't just one factor, it was the combination. You needed the right bow, the right technique, the right bodies shaped over years.
And then the coordinated application on the battlefield.
thousands of men functioning as a unit. It was a military revolution.
It's this human element behind the revolution that makes it all so tangible. This dedication from childhood is something we can barely imagine today.
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean traditional archery?
Yes, you mean this.
You mean traditional archery?
You mean tradition archery, in part four.
You mean tradition archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean traditional archery?
That many thing that it with some please, but be based in number one. Invisibility, the cold and the paddle of. And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
It was this traditation from childhood.
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating. And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
The productive correction was explain an line from these mows and mansions and their missions of many arm and close. And the disclose is completely make along.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
You mean this traditional archery?
And yet, this tradition lives on. That's what's fascinating.
Absolutely. There's a vibrant community of people who shoot with historical longbows. Not with modern compound bows, but with replicas of the original weapons.
The technique is the same. The Mediterranean draw, the focus on the back muscles. Of course, hardly anyone shoots those 140-pound bows today. Just a few specialists. But the basic principle...
The basic principle is identical. And when you try it once, you gain a completely different respect for these historical archers.
there are also events where you can experience this. Medieval fairs, special archery events. You can often try a traditional bow yourself there.
And suddenly you realize, 45 pounds already feels heavy. And then you think about the 140 pounds these men shot, 100 times a day.
It makes history tangible. That's something different from just reading about it.
Yeah, and that's actually what drives us. This connection between history and experience.
History needs to be touched. Or in this case, drawn.
Well said. And for anyone who's curious now, at battlemerchant.com you'll find a large selection of traditional longbows and everything that goes with them. From beginner bows to authentic replicas.
And on the blog, there's much more on topics like this. We've only covered a small section today. The history of warfare, of equipment, of the people behind it all. There's endless depth there.
If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to stop by. Or listen to our other episodes. We have a lot more planned.
And if you want to try a longbow yourself, start with a light one. Your back will thank you.
What remains at the end? Respect for people who dedicated their lives to an art, who shaped their bodies to wield a weapon that decided battles.
And the realization that behind every historical weapon stood people. With stories, with families, with lives we can only begin to imagine.
With that, thanks for listening.
Until next time.
Stay curious.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.